History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. Our program today is evidence that they don't have to go untold, and we're going to tell you about a book in which you can read some pretty amazing stories about a pretty amazing individual. Our goal has always been to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And we learn quite a bit, don't we? We're educated, but we're also entertained. And there's inspiration we can be on the receiving end of as well. You're going to hear from a 99-year-old World War II veteran in a bit, but first, from an author of a book about his life, and you can meet them both this coming Wednesday, October 15th, if you're in the Golden State. The book is available on Amazon, and I have it linked for you on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page and at hometownheroesradio.com. It's called A Hero and Advocate for All Others. It's about the remarkable life of Vern Schmidt. But before we hear from him, let's hear from Laura Bailey about the origin of this book project. They're both going to be at the Fresno Yosemite International Airport on October 15th to welcome home the veterans on the latest Central Valley Honor Flight. And for a donation of $20 or more to that Honor Flight cause, you can get a signed copy of the book. Supplies are limited. It'll be first come, first serve. They'll start signing around 5:30 there on October 15th. Here's author Laura Bailey on where this book idea came from.
To be quite honest with you, it had a lot to do with the fact that he served with my grandfather. My grandfather passed away when I was 16 years old, long before I was mature enough or truly cared enough to ask him his stories. And then as soon as I lost him, I realized, in addition to my grandfather, what I lost was a World War II veteran. And over the course of many years and many museum visits and air shows, I finally went back to school and was working on my master's degree in World War II studies. And during some of my research, I found Vern, who, and as fate would have it, as God would have it, actually, had served with my grandfather. I met Vern, and just, anyone that knows him, and I'm sure that most people in this area do know him very, very well. He has to be one of the most phenomenal, grateful people I've ever met in my life. And to have seen what he has seen and lived through what he did during the war and throughout his life, I was drawn to him, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. And so, in God's perfect will and his favor, God gave me a chance to learn about my grandfather and see what my grandfather saw through Vern's eyes. And not that he replaced my grandfather, but it just gave me the opportunity to have a relationship that I had lost, if that makes any sense. And you know, Vern and I we first met in Atlanta at a 2nd Cavalry reunion, and I spent the whole day with him at Fort Benning. He was my personal tour guide through the museum. As you well know, the stories are plentiful, and he loves to share them. It's important to him for that history to be told. And at the end of that evening, the first day that we had met in person, he looked me in the face and told me that he didn't want me to leave. And he thanked me for pushing the history forward, and in his words, and with tears in both of our eyes, he said, "It's because of you us old guys can move on, because we know that somebody's going to tell our story behind us." And in that moment, the momentum just gained, and from there, I could not get enough. I read, I spoke to him many times, met him many times. I felt led to lead the charge in writing his story. It's not just a story about war, it's a story about history, and it's a story about the Lord's presence, the Lord's protection, the Lord's will in his life. And for me, it's all about God and following where he had me on this journey, and thankfully he brought me to Fresno.
And I want to ask you more about the book, but you said something else there that I know piqued our listeners' ears, and what you shared about getting to know your grandfather a little better through Vern is what I hear from a lot of our listeners, is why they listen to this program. When they hear a World War II veteran talking, it fills in some blanks for them that their father, their grandfather never shared. But you said a master's in World War II history, and I think a lot of people didn't know you could get a degree like that. What did that do for you, and would you have any advice for someone who says, you know what, I might want to try that?
When the program started in 2019, it was the only master's program in the world, and I believe that is still the truth. I was one of the first graduates, and because I was so hungry for the history and to learn more about Vern. As for what it did for me, I mean, I truly stand behind that the American soldiers were the greatest generation. In addition to a history degree, it was also a humanities degree. And what it taught me, and you can ask my husband, because he told me that he saw a change in me as a human being. It made me a more compassionate person. Not that I was cold-hearted to begin with, but it gives you a perspective of it wasn't just us that was in the war, and it wasn't just us as Americans that were fighting the war, and it wasn't just the soldiers that were, the mothers and fathers that were left behind, the children that were left without a father. And it really sculpted the trajectory of our world. And, you know, it's always a story of the good guys and the bad guys, but there were good people in those countries as well that were just being drug along through something that they had no choice. So it was important to me to look at the history from a global humanitarian perspective, because, you know, God loves us each equally, regardless of our nationality.
And you said that getting to know Vern helped you understand your grandfather in a different light. Do you have any specific examples of maybe a story you heard or just an epiphany you had that said, oh, now that makes sense, or now I can see what I couldn't understand before?
We're from North Carolina, the mountains of North Carolina, actually. My grandfather, when he came back from the war, he had three brothers that also served in the war. And what it did to their family, and, you know, a lot of times the alcohol was part of their return and their integration into, you know, reentry into their home lives. And, you know, that was the case for him as well. But, you know, I didn't really understand it as a child when I was told about it. Fortunately, he was able to quit before I have any memory of it. But it definitely dictated a part of my grandmother's memories and how hard it was for her. So she was left here as a new bride. They were the typical World War II story where they got married on this day and he shipped out the next. And then she went into one of the factories in Greensboro, North Carolina, to work. And when he came home, you know, it's not always the romantic story that was depicted. You know, there's a readjustment. For years, I think they struggled to some degree. But the epiphany, I guess you would say, would be more of an understanding as to why he came back the way he did. Because he was part of the 90th Infantry Division, and he was part of the Battle of the Bulge and the press across France into Germany. It was in Czechoslovakia post-war, preparing to ship to the Pacific. And, I mean, there's just a lot there, and he earned a Bronze Star for quote-unquote taking out a German machine gun nest. And in the throes of war, you know, you have to do those things, but the reconciliation comes later. And I think that's what's caused me to do the most processing and most thinking about his service.
And as far as this book about Vern Schmidt, A Hero and an Advocate for All Others, how'd you come up with that title? What inspired that?
Oh, wow, that's a great question. Vern will be the first one, and he has criticized me many times since the book came out, although he did have final authority, that he is no hero, and I appreciate that about him. But the hero part is, in addition to his service, I felt like all the soldiers were heroes. Front lines, in the offices, they all served, and it took them all. But I consider him to be a hero in how he's lived his life as well. The reason I feel like he's an advocate for all others is because here he is on the cusp of his 100th birthday, and he is out here pushing this history, and he's trying to make sure that none of us forget it, and he is advocating on behalf of the World War II generation.
And I'm sure you had some expectations when you started the project about where the book would go or what stories you would feature and all that. Was there anything along the way, just in the process, that surprised you a little bit? Or that is, as well as you knew Vern, you said, wow, that's really something special. I need to try to capture that in print.
There are several items throughout the book, if I may. First thing I want to share is I had a short list of questions I wished I could have asked my grandfather, like, which troop ship were you on? You know, where did you go to basic training, etc.? And another one was, what was your favorite scripture? Because those are conversations I never had with my grandfather. So that led into the story of he and his father reciting the 91st Psalm when they were working in the orchards in the San Joaquin Valley. Of course, he told me every other story. But the prayer story of the church in Reedley that he went to, where someone was praying 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for the duration of the war, and that all came back home. And that's just a testament to prayer and God's favor and God's protection. And Vern is just, he's amazing. I heard you say last night at dinner that you've learned something new. You've heard many of the stories, but he pops one on you. Well into the book where we were researching, and we just dropped our jaws when we were interviewing him over the phone one night. He said, oh, yeah, that's when I was up and I was working during the Nuremberg trials. And we were like, you never told us that, you know, and that's just such a key piece of information. But in retrospect, there's so much more we could have put into the book. Each time I talk to him, like you said, I'm hearing something for the first time, and I just, there could be a part two. There really could.
Well, and maybe there will be, because he's still going strong and interacting with people. If someone's never met Vern, maybe they're like you and they didn't hear their grandfather's stories, their father's stories, their uncle's stories, whomever. What's the number one reason you would tell them that they should read this book? What are they going to get out of it that they wouldn't get if they don't read it?
The first thing that comes to mind is his faith. You know, from the time he was born all the way up and until today, he's had quite the story to tell. And we really worked hard to keep that thread evident throughout the book so that people can follow that and leave with that, you know, regardless of whether he's standing amongst his comrades that have just fallen or whether he's selling tractors in the valley. I mean, you always feel that light and you see that light, and that light leads you to the Lord, and that's what we were trying to project.
When you add up all the close calls, I'm sure there are some that are in the book and others that aren't in the book, but was there one story, one situation he was in that really just kind of grabbed you and said, boy, I can't imagine that, or I don't understand how he survived that, or just really made an impression on you?
The one story, and selfishly, my grandfather's involved in the story. I guess that's why it resonates more. But there was a particular incident in Pfaffenheck, Germany, and he refers to it as Machine Gun Hill. And they're at the top of this riverbank, and the Germans are coming up out of the water, just one right after the other. And Vern was in E Company, and I've since found out my grandfather was in G Company, so they were shoulder to shoulder. Their orders were to not let them, you know, come to the top and overtake them and their weapons. And the fact that he and my grandfather and their comrades had to just continually mow these individuals down, it's hard to wrap your head around. Just to hear Vern talk about that, he can be very sympathetic in the moment, but also very matter of fact. You know, in that moment, it was the decision that had to be made. But then be able to sit here all these years later and hear him talk about going to the very cemetery where all those were buried and pay his respects and reflect on that moment, you know, now 80 years ago, that, as I tell you, it's given me cold chills. And so that's probably the most powerful one that he recites to me.
Well, I just, I want to say thank you for writing this book. I think a lot of people have told him over the years, hey, you need to write a book. And he was never indulgent enough to do that himself. But perfect timing that this is out now just ahead of his 100th birthday. Is there anything else about the book or what the process of putting it together has done for you that you think we ought to know?
I have two answers to that question. The first one that I would share with any veteran, whether they have seen wartime or if they were just, if they served during peacetime, your family wants to know your history. So if you can just take a moment and write down where you went to basic, where you enlisted, you know, how you were transported to where, these are the things that your children and your grandchildren are going to work desperately to find out. I have a 5-month gap in my grandfather's service that I'm trying my best to figure out, and it's a puzzle. And I'm sure he's smiling and enjoying the fact that I'm digging through. That's one thing that I would say. But as far as what I gain the most from the book, personally, is just delving into someone else's life and in the processes of seeing what he went through and the 16 million other people went through. On my tough days, it makes me know how easy I've got it and how grateful I am that they did what they did.
Perspective is a powerful thing. I thought of one more thing I need to ask you, because, you know, especially in today's world, when a book comes out, a lot of times the author's motivation is, hey, I want to get my name out there. Maybe I want to make some money. That's certainly not the case with this project. And from what I understand, you're not keeping a penny of the proceeds of this book.
No, we are not. And when we were writing the book, before we put the first word on the piece of paper, that was our agreement between Coy Ackerman and I, and Reagan Steele is the third author. She came in and helped us as well. Our goal was for Vern to take all the money. We told him, you know, we didn't want any of the proceeds. We just, and to honor him specifically, but in the dedication, you'll see my grandfather, Coy's father, and Reagan's great uncle. We dedicated the book to them. But when we got to the end and we were wrapping things up, I contacted Vern. I'm like, okay, when I set this up, I need to know where to send the money. And he said, I want it to go to the Central Valley Honor Flight. He gave me the information. He gave me your name. And so whenever we receive the royalties, they come to me. I turn around, I send him a report because it's important to me that people know I'm above board. But I send him a report and I write Central Valley a check. I would definitely like to see more veterans go to Washington, D.C. I want to thank you for letting me come into your community to be a part of this history. I feel like a welcomed outsider. It's surreal. It's just a dream come true that I didn't really know I dreamt. I mean, it's just like God. He makes it better than I could ever imagine. But I thank you for bringing me into your community and for what you and Vern are doing for this history, because it needs to be told. So thank you.
It does need to be told. And it's quite a story captured in A Hero and an Advocate for All Others. Order your copy from Amazon or through the link at hometownheroesradio.com and come meet the author and the subject in Fresno, California on Wednesday, October 15th. When we come back, the young man on the cover of the book, he was 19 in that photo. He's 99 now and turns 100 in January. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. A reminder, you can meet World War II veteran Vern Schmidt and an author of the book about Vern's life, while also welcoming home dozens of veterans from their honor flight if you head to Fresno, California on October 15th. All that info is listed for you at hometownheroesradio.com. The book is called A Hero and Advocate for All Others. We heard from Laura Bailey about what inspired that title. Now let's hear from the man whose life is captured in it. 99-year-old Vern Schmidt, a veteran of the 90th Infantry Division in World War II and the 2nd Cavalry Division afterwards. Vern, what's it like when you see a stack of books with your teenage face on them and a line of people as far as you can see waiting to get your 99-year-old autograph on them?
Well, you know, I have to say, I guess I'm humbled and surprised and happy that that book has seemed like the book has caught on pretty well. The sales have gone well, and the three people involved whose names are on the front of the book all come from the same area in North Carolina, and each one had a part of putting the book together. Got a call to go down and meet a gentleman who, a Jewish fellow who runs a Jewish organization down there in Arizona. And he said, Vern, we're going to interview you from the standpoint of being American GI in Europe. We're also going to have several from the Holocaust, several survivors, Jewish people who survived the Holocaust. They're going to give their story, and then I want you to give yours of what you saw and how you reacted on from this occasion down at the Flossenbürg concentration camp. And one of the authors heard about it, and she went down there to listen. We really didn't know who she really was. I just knew she was a friend that had a family that served with me during World War II. So she sat and gathered information. Laura was a little bit different. She's an unusual lady and also came to Fresno to see me. She said, "Did you ever write something down? You got a book?" I said, "No, I have a little story I wrote for my kids, my three children. Can I see it?" And I said, "Yeah." I'd like to take this with me and read it over. She never said anything about a book coming out. So when the book was published, I get one of the first copies of her book. I didn't even know there was a book coming, but she shared it with me, and how do you react when somebody writes your story? You know, Laura has been special. Her family's been special. Her husband's been special to us. They've been in our home here in Fresno, and I'm glad you asked her to share with you. I think we're going to have a nice evening there. That's on the 15th.
October 15th at the Fresno Yosemite International Airport. I don't think we'll have enough books for everyone who shows up that night, because usually there's about 1,000 or 1,500 people, but we'll sell books till they're all out. And I'm looking at something else here that you showed me the last time we had an honor flight. It's in a box from the Patton Foundation, and it's a couple dog tags in there. What's the story of these dog tags that you've got here?
Well, being Helen is the granddaughter of General Patton, she had these specially made, like the official dog tag that we wear during World War II. You can see the notch. Do you know what that notch was for?
For your tooth, right?
It was if you were dead, they took one of your dog tags and opened your mouth and placed that over one of the teeth. Yep. And so she had one made, or two of them made. One is General Patton's official dog tag remarks and so forth on it. And the other one is his lovely bride. When the war was over officially in the first week of May of 1945, General Eisenhower released him to go home to California and bring his wife back with him to be with him while he's serving over there, because Eisenhower had plans to form the Third Army, which was going to be one of the official units to serve in the time over there. And so anyway, that's General Patton's wife, and they assigned some numbers and stuff to her. Those are real people.
So General Patton's granddaughter Helen came right here to where we're sitting now, to your home in Fresno. Did you give her one of your books? Did you sign a book for the granddaughter of your commanding general?
She has a book.
I bet when you met General Patton, you didn't think you'd be signing a book for his granddaughter someday.
Well, I did meet General Patton over in Europe. In fact, he came down to the 90th Division to visit our general. And we heard he was in town, and I was kind of fortunate. I was a Jeep driver for the company captain, and I had some free time, and I heard about, they said General Patton is going to be here and meet the general on such and such a day. Well, I planted that in the back of my head, and on that such and such a day, I drove right down to 90 Division headquarters, where I knew our general would come out of the door. And he came out of the door, and General Patton followed him, and they walked right by my Jeep where I was standing. Now, I met General Patton. Now, he didn't meet me. He might have seen me standing there, wondered who this truck driver is standing out here. He should be busy. But anyway, I did meet him right there, and to me it was a thrill, you know, because I did a stupid thing. When the war ended, I was over there in Germany and so forth. I was down in the area in southern Germany when General Patton was in his personal armored car and was struck by another truck, and he was killed in that accident. His staff car had a metal screen between the front seat and the back seat, so he could be pretty secure sitting back there in the seat. Well, when this truck hit him, it threw him up against this metal screen, and a portion of it took just slice right through his forehead, and he was dead, you know? And one of the units that I served with, the commanding officer, a full colonel, he and General Patton had gone through West Point together and received their commission in World War I. So that unit was asked by General Patton's wife and others, "You're in charge of General Patton's funeral." And that was the unit I was serving with. One day a guy came, I was in the office working there, and he came down and he said, "Schmidt, I noticed you're 6 foot something." I said, "Yeah." He said, "We need some pallbearers for General Patton's funeral." And he says, "We're doing it on a voluntary basis." I said, "You're one of those that we chose to do it if you wish." Well, we were about 150, 200 miles away from where he was going to be buried up in Luxembourg at the Luxembourg American Cemetery. And I had been there. And this was in the dead of winter, January. And I said, "Okay, how do we get from here to where the funeral is going to be, where he's going to be buried?" And he said, "Well, you guys were riding in the back of a 6x6 truck." I said, "Is this voluntary or am I supposed to be there?" "Oh, no," he said, "Vern, we're just coming down and picking guys that are 6 foot tall or bigger to be pallbearers," because Patton was a tall man. And I said, "Well, if that's how we're going, count me out." You know, talk about a fool. That was me. I turned down an offer to be one of the pallbearers at General Patton's gravesite. When I met Helen, I said, "Helen, you'll never believe what I did to your grandfather." I said, "I turned down being a pallbearer." She said, "Vern, I probably would have done the same thing knowing how cold it was and how you had to get there. Forget about it." I said, "I can't forget about it." I said, "I've been back to his grave at least 3 times. And the first time I went back to his grave, I got on my hands and knees, put my hand on his cross. And I said, "General, please forgive me for what I did to you. You were honoring me. Your people were honoring me to be a pallbearer." And I said it was too cold. She said, "Vern, don't worry about it." I might have done the same thing. But I didn't. Both my big toes were already turning color. And if they'd gone to black, they'd have had to cut both of them off. But I tried to protect myself, and they slowly went back to halfway normal. And today they're still cold. One day you can just feel one of them's cold, the other toes are warm. But anyway, that's my story of General Patton. I think if we would have had more General Pattons over there, the war would have ended sooner. He took some awful stories about him when he supposedly slapped a couple of guys. You know, who knows what story? Only he was there, and only he talked to those kids. And yet the story comes out in all kinds of magazines and, the stories we heard over the radio and whatever about him slapping these two kids. You know, maybe he put some sense in their head by slapping them. Anyway, he took a real beating on that alone, but I have sat under one of his speeches. I tell you, thrill your heart to hear him talk and honoring the troops. "It's an honor for me," he said, "to be in charge of these troops." And like I say, he was a real guy. He knew what he was doing. That's my story about my friend General Patton, that I had to go to his granddaughter and ask for forgiveness.
And you've got a lot of stories, and a lot of them are in this book, and we can't tell them all, but I'd love to, for our listeners, to hear a few of them. I've lost count of how many times I've talked to you about some of the things you did in World War II, but a lot of the ones that move me the most come back to your family and the place where you grew up in Reedley, California. And in fact, on November 4th in Reedley at Sierra View Homes, there's going to be a fundraising dinner for Central Valley Honor Flight that you're going to be one of the guests of honor for. You had to do some pretty tough jobs out there in Reedley. Did you really plow a field with a horse, a horse-drawn plow? Did you really do that?
Yes, I did. My dad was a foreman on a ranch that had 3 ranches. And before tractors came out, hey, we had a horse in the corral back there, and that was his job, to get hooked up to a plow. And when I was working with my father during either during the summer on or during the week. Well, I'd work on Saturdays for my father as he was a foreman on these three ranches. So we had to do, if you had a vineyard, you did an annual job called a French plow. You had a, it was a special single blade plow made to go right next to the vineyard, to the vine itself, and get in the dirt and throw dirt away, and then fresh dirt put back where you remove this. And one day I was asked to go get the horse, and I got behind the plow and I plowed with this horse. So now that makes me a real old guy, I guess.
Well, you won't be 100 till January, so you can still throw the young card out there. And we've talked before about your family. Your brother, your older brother, Glenn, would end up as a prisoner of war, have a long military career, not just in the Army, but the Air Force as well. But it's probably been a while since I've asked you about December 7th, 1941. You have a clear memory of how you got that news that Japan had bombed Pearl Harbor?
This was a Sunday, and we'd been in church. Ironically, in this church, there was three of us teenagers named Vernon. So we kind of stuck together, and we decided after church we would go downtown and find one of the food restaurants and have a little food. So we're walking down the street from the church. It was probably about a half a mile from the church, going into Main Street in Reedley. And there was a restaurant there. In fact, part of my family helped build that restaurant. But anyway, we walked and got right up by it, and the doors were open, and the radio was blaring. And we couldn't figure out what this was, so we stopped there and listened. This was December 7th. They were reporting about the Japanese bombing Pearl Harbor. Now, I didn't even know where Pearl Harbor was, but we knew it was a long ways away. But we listened, and the guy was, you know, it was a reporter giving the blow-by-blow description of the Japanese bombing at Pearl Harbor. I think we almost instantly had a hatred for them. And yet in school, I had many Japanese friends. Reedley had a whole bunch of them living. They were all farmers, all workers, and their parents were dynamite for them to study and become something other than a farmer. I've sat out on the front lawn during weekdays in school, shared my lunch with the Japanese. My mother made peanut butter sandwiches on homemade bread. Now, that's the best bread you can get, but you have to hold it together or it crumbles and falls apart. So the Japanese, they bought boughten bread at the bakery, and all they did was put a slab of bologna in between it. So they had two slices of boughten bread and a slice of bologna inside. And I could hardly wait to meet these guys and trade my jelly sandwich, homemade bread, and they were ready to trade. They loved my mom's cooking. So anyway, but we got very friendly with these people. They were, you know, some of them were stopped at my house, and we'd play outdoor games on the ground with balls and so forth, and they became personal friends. And then came this war, and they gathered them all up. It came to the Fresno Fairgrounds and then also north of town here, and stuffed them full of them, Japanese families, ready to haul them away. We didn't know where or what or was there any. Anyway, I recall a special train came into Reedley, backed up in there and on the Santa Fe tracks, and they loaded up the Japanese. Something I didn't know is my first wife, Donna, she was with a group in school that also thought these Japanese were nice people. And in where she was, they dismissed those kids to walk down to the train depot and say goodbye to these Japanese people. I think that was probably one of the best things that Reedley High School did and made a send-off. You know, there was tears in their eyes and all that good stuff. Years later, our class of 43, we start holding reunions. And we had a bunch of people show up for our reunions. One of the guys said we were making arrangements to have the meeting and so forth and form a class reunion. And one of the guys said, you know what we ought to do at this reunion? We ought to call all the Japanese people that we can think of that were in our class of 43, invite them down there to be our guests. And to help them out, we're going to go down to Reedy High School office and have them make a diploma for each one of these people. We got together, had our original meeting there, and they gave me a diploma and said, that fellow right over there, when we'll call his name off, you go over there and you present him with his diploma. I went over there and I got so teary-eyed I couldn't hardly talk, presenting him with a diploma. And he saw it all wrapped, wound up with a ribbon around it, and big tears come down his cheeks. I mean, it was a crying session down there for a while, passing out diplomas way back when, and from 1943 to these guys. I'll never forget that. And I've run onto them since, and we've talked about it. The 442nd Regimental Combat Team, which was in Europe, had a lot of really Japanese people in it, and they had a big meeting here in Fresno, and I went and joined them and met some of these guys. Here comes those guys that we cried together when they got diplomas. But, you know, they were people just like us, you know, just like us. Paul, they ate their sandwiches. They did their work in the field. They were very industrious people, and most all the parents could not be citizens. Our country would not allow them to be citizens. So some of my classmates who were sons and daughters, our government made them the owners of the property. Amazing. You know, mom and dad, they didn't have nothing. But they were the ones on the farm that made sure everything happened, that things got done right and pruned and irrigated and whatever happened on the farm. You know, I still have that utmost respect for those people. I personally feel that our government, they didn't make a mistake, but they kind of handled it kind of roughshod. But they knew, because the Japanese were already, with their Navy, was already up in Alaska doing some bombing already. And our government, in my estimation, said they could come right down here to the coast and start shelling their own people. So our government said, we got to do something. And it may not all turn out like we thought it would, but anyway, this area here in California was every Japanese they could find was gone. And the ships did come down. Two of them, or two or three came down, shelled Long Beach and up near, up close to Los Angeles, and one up north of that even. And then one ship actually fired a live heavy artillery shell from a ship outside of Portland, Oregon. And it landed in the forest and killed a whole family, ironically. They were in their car, and this big shell landed in there, killed every single one of them. So it was unfortunate times. Our government probably did what they thought was the proper thing to do, but it didn't sound good to some people. And many of our people right here in town, in the area of Reedy and Fresno and Sanger, whatever, some of the neighbors said, just give us the keys to your stuff. We'll take care of your ranch till you get back. I know some of the people today who did that. You know, they could have stole the thing and when they come home said, this is ours now. No, they gave it back to them just like they found it and tried to respect it. So I think our people who knew the real story did the right thing and respected them and became friends and whatever. So those are real World War II stories.
It's time for our final break, but much more to come with the soon-to-be 100-year-old World War II veteran. And you can meet him this coming Wednesday, October 15th, at the Fresno Yosemite International Airport in Fresno, California. And join him in welcoming his fellow veterans home from their honor flight to Washington, D.C. All the proceeds from the book go to that all-volunteer nonprofit organization. And Vern and author Laura Bailey will be signing copies of the book, A Hero and Advocate for All Others, on Wednesday evening there. Go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for more information, and we'll be right back after this. Ever feel like that dollar just doesn't go as far anymore? Well, join the club. Actually, you really should join the club. I mean, join the more than 350,000 members of EECU, the not-for-profit credit union now in 12 California counties. Free online and mobile banking, more than 30,000 co-op ATMs, and not just fair, but fantastic rates on auto loans, mortgages, and home equity lines of credit. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today, or just call this number, 1-800-538-3328. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake.
Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting with 99-year-old Vern Schmidt ahead of his book signing, which coincides with welcoming home Central Valley Honor Flight on October 15th in Fresno, California. All the proceeds from Vern's book go to that organization, which flies veterans free of charge to Washington, D.C., so they can visit their memorials.
You know, you mentioned earlier the church that you were a part of there in Reedley, Full Gospel Tabernacle, and I've seen the altar of that church at the Reedley Museum, and it's got a list of 52 names hanging from it. And there's a story behind those names that every time I hear you tell this story, I get goosebumps. And now I love watching how a crowd reacts when you tell that story. So I can't see all our radio listeners, but I can let you tell that story. What's the story of those 52 names?
Well, in this church, when a person got his draft report and went off to war, they had a plaque right by the pulpit there in the church. And they put his name there, U.S. Navy, another one, U.S. Army, Marines, whatever. And they put a name up there for everyone out of the church or a friend of people from the church. And that's where they got those multiple names. And someone in that church, including my mom and dad, someone in that church, 24/7, was on their knees mentioning our name in prayer. God, protect that guy. Watch over him. May it be possible for him to come home unscathed. And, you know, two people in my wedding, my brother and a close friend, both were severely wounded. My brother was taken captive, became a prisoner of war, and his wounds, both in his facial area and in his back, never even got an aspirin. Never got an aspirin from the Germans. You know, that almost makes you anger inside, you know. Why didn't they help these guys? When he was finally liberated, after 3 months in Bad Orb concentration camp, because he was never been treated physically from his wounds, they flew him home and flew him to Southern California to a recuperation facility. Mm-hmm. He got his first medication 3 months after he was wounded in California, at a rehab medical station. So, you know, he paid a price. And the other fellow who was in my wedding, he also was severely wounded in the Battle of the Bulge. Came home, survived, got married, all that good stuff. And real friends. But that church, they were determined that those guys went off to war to serve us and protect us. The least we can do is get on our knees and call him out by name and said, "Dear Lord, watch over Vern, watch over Glenn, watch over Paul, watch over George over there." And like I say, every single one came home. You know, that's a real testimony, you know. And I've shared that many times because I felt people should know. Some of them called him, "Boy, guy, you were sure lucky." You know, in fact, a guy in my book said, "Boy, Vern, you were a lucky guy." My reaction in there was kind of, I just said luck was never one of my favorites. But I said the good Lord brought me armaments. I met a Jewish fellow over there who they forced into a factory to make armaments to destroy American people. We had some Jewish work in our kitchen after the war was over to let our own people sit and eat without having to work. And we had these Jewish people from a camp come down and work with us in this kitchen. One of them I kind of befriended a little bit, and he came to me one day and asked, he said, Schmidt, did you see or feel or experience any German artillery shells that didn't explode? And I said, funny you should ask. We were in the woods, and the Germans were just on the other side of the hill, and they knew where we were. And they began dropping in special shells that would burst and make contact with whatever was nearby. And I said, I ran and fell into a small hole that the Germans, I suppose the Germans had built, and I laid in there, and a shell landed less than 10 feet from me, big artillery shell, about 24 inches long, about 6 or 8 inches in diameter. Landed in there, and I heard the explosion. Then when it hit with a big whoomph, it just threw dirt all over me, but it never exploded. But telling this story to this Jewish guy, a great big grin came over his face. He said, maybe I saved your life, Vern. But somebody did. If on the firing device of one of these projectiles, if they leave a little tiny spring out or a little tiny screw in the firing device, it wouldn't fire. And this fellow was working on a line where those things went by. And when it came to his point to put the screw and the spring in, he just took it and put it under his tongue, and it went on by, and the next person just did some of the other assembly. So it was never known who actually did it. He said, had they caught us, we'd have been shot on the spot. But he said, until we left that place in the evening to go back to our habitation, we'd spit the spring or the screw out on the ground out there. Otherwise, it was under our tongue all day long. But he said, you were our friends. We had to do something to save you. And it just tickled him pink that I had been one of his guys. He said, maybe I'm the guy that did it, Vern. So, but those, again, how often would you meet a guy like that?
Well, and that, I've never met anyone who's met more amazing people all over the world than you have. You're a magnet for it. And I know you're not done. And hopefully a lot of them are going to come on October 15th at the Fresno Yosemite International Airport to get your book, to read more of the stories. You and I have talked many times about the Flossenbürg concentration camp, and you just told that story about one of the Jewish prisoners who you met during that experience. There's another thing that you were involved in that I think people find fascinating. And they, in fact, they made a whole movie about it called The Monuments Men, where there were these treasures from occupied Europe that the Nazis had stored in salt mines. And you actually saw that firsthand.
And there again, I can't explain it, but we were in the town where salt mines were underground. And we threw a restriction on civilians being out after, I think it was 6 o'clock in the evening. This was April of 1945. When our men stopped these women, they said, hey, you got to be in a house. You're not supposed to be out after 6 o'clock. And the lady says, see her over there? She's pregnant. She's about to deliver a baby. We came out here to help her and take her over to a lady that's going to help her deliver her baby. Said, well, you better get over there quick. And the lady said, by the way, do you see that tower right there? Do you know what that is? No. Says, you need to go over there. If you get in that tower and go down, you'll go down 500 feet and you'll find something there that we don't know what it is. Something. We see trucks come here daily and unload in a cart, and they go down in a big elevator, huge elevator. I've rode in it myself. And we go down 500 feet where during the early 1900s, they had removed salt out of there. I forget the word. Anyway, they took the salt chunks and made salt for all of Europe, and they were called the salt mines. Our people didn't know one thing about that, but our division was chosen to go down that shaft, and they could not believe what they were seeing down there. It was wall-to-wall boxes, pictures, all kinds of stuff that Hitler had and his people had confiscated from, you name every country over there in Europe, there was something in the bottom of that where the salt had been. Our guys went down there, and they came back up, and they called General Patton, General Eisenhower, and several other generals. Says, you guys got to go down and see what's down there that belongs to people all over Europe. They could not believe it. Rembrandt paintings and all kinds of famous people who had made stuff, and it was in there that Hitler had confiscated. There was American money, German money, French money, Polish money. There was gold bullions, like a 12 by 12 by 12, solid gold that represented thousands of dollars. Today it'd be millions of dollars. And it was all stacked right there. So that's why our guys called General Patton, felt he should go down there and see it himself. And General Patton said, okay, we're going to get American trucks over here and load all of that stuff and take it to the city of Frankfurt. There's a huge building there that we have been in, and we can store it in there and sort it out slowly and give it back to who it belonged to. Now, this is General Patton talking. He says, this belongs to people. This is stolen property. It belongs to people. Ironically, they were able to disperse of almost everything down there, with the exception of, I think there was $300,000 or $400,000 that they couldn't recognize. And they turned around and gave it to the Jewish people to help their people who were incarcerated. So the money, whatever, somebody was blessed by a pregnant woman, I guess you'd have to say, because our guy stopped her. Today, if you go there, there's a Jeep down there with the lights on, 90th Infantry Division, down there. And it's just, I've been there twice, taking my different family members down there. Unbelievable what you could see down there. There's a huge, huge auditorium. There's a stage built in there. There's lights, air conditioning, everything. And they charge people up on ground level to go down for a concert or something. So that's a money-making organization, belonged to the Germans. My first time there, they wouldn't let us go down unless we had authority or guards or something. And a lady went down with us. We rode down in American trucks, went down the elevator, then got into trucks and went around and come over there. And she helped tell us what it was all about. And it was her family that began to make a money-making organization that held concerts down there and charged people. And when I came the second time and went down, she said, hey, you're American. You've been here before. She recognized me. You know, like I say, you can run, but you can't hide. But we enjoyed that. It's, you know, they came with almost a convoy of American vehicles and took that stuff down to, and they even had armed airplanes up on top to follow this convoy down, because I mean, today it would be billions of dollars, and they were all going in trucks with American drivers down there to Frankfurt to put it in this big storage building. You know, I looked back and I said, you know, we weren't all bad. I said, we did some good things, and that was one of them. And here I was, a part of the unit that was actually made it all happen. Now, I was a PFC. I was a guard. I was not chosen to be part of those people that did this, because my unit was commanded to go on up ahead and liberate another town up there. In fact, we got involved in liberating the concentration camp Buchenwald. There's credit made to our unit for helping liberate the Buchenwald concentration camp. So maybe we were chosen to do more dangerous work. One was saving money, and the other one was spending money, but firing at the Germans. Anyway, I've met people over there, the German people over there, who remember us back in 1945. You know, small world.
Yeah, and you were a 19-year-old kid then, but come January, you're going to turn 100 years old. And I've known you for more than 20 of those years, and you have just as much energy and enthusiasm today as you did back then. So some people may hear you and they say, well, what is this guy's secret? What is it that that motivates you or inspires you or keeps you going?
Well, you know, we were a part of history making in World War II. And people should know the suffering, should know the joy, should know the perils, should know the bad and the good of what we did. In fact, the story in World War II, Battle of the Bulge, I spent 1 week the last week of the Battle of the Bulge with that unit, and then we moved into Germany and kept moving till we wound up in Czechoslovakia and won the war. But, you know, I'm so grateful that I came home. My brother came home. My brother has since passed away. In fact, my whole family, I'm the only one left other than my children and some of his children. And so, you know, I'm grateful for being able to share some of that. Otherwise, they would never be told. You know, I think our news media was probably told what they could say and what they couldn't say. And we saw stuff that they probably didn't want us to share with the rest. So, but, you know, I was involved, and I'm just grateful that I'm alive and well and able to share my story, which I feel, I'm not bragging, I'm just reporting of what we went through over there. My two big toes are still colored and cold. That's a long time. That's 80 years ago. But it's still with me today. My hearing is bad. You notice I wear a hearing aid. I received some compensation from the VA because from the intense shelling and so forth, we were awarded some compensation for our ears going bad on us. So, you know, I'm just grateful for, this is a wonderful country to be in. And we're in a wonderful town that recognizes a lot of this. We got a lot of good people here in Fresno that have shared with us on whatever we did and whatever we went through. And we started out talking about the Japanese. You know, they've been such good friends of mine. They paid a real price, you know, but they rose above it. They rose above it, which is important. And you got to pat them on the back for what they did. Paul, I always enjoy listening to you and what you do for our city and what you do on your Saturday program. You've shared story after story after story about our GIs and what they did. And I think a lot of people know you just because of that. And, yeah, he's that guy that's on Saturday, talks about these guys that were in camps and so forth. You know, I'm glad they know that somebody's listening. So your program keeps moving. Wow, what a blessing.
What a blessing Vern Schmidt has been to so many for so long. And if you've never had the privilege of meeting him, you want to be there October 15th in Fresno, California. That's your chance. He'll also be speaking at a fundraiser for Central Valley Honor Flight in his native Reedley, California on November 4th. You can find all of that information as well at hometownheroesradio.com. We're out of time for today, but thank you so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.